Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi there, this is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. Thanks a lot for joining me for today's podcast, Coronavirus Facts Only. Every day around this time, we talk with two doctors about coronavirus and COVID-19. We'll get to our regular guest, Lou Cares Dr. Fred Buchholz, in a few minutes. But first, let's talk about those new guidelines for restarting youth and high school sports. They were just released by the St. Louis Healthcare Systems Collaborate, involving BJC Healthcare, Washington University Physicians, Mercy, and SSM Health's Lou Care. Joining us now to talk about these guidelines is Katie Smith. Katie is the Sports Medicine Outreach Manager at SSM Health. Katie, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
So tell us about these new guidelines being offered for youth and high school sports.
Yeah, so recently SSM Health collaborated with BJC Healthcare and Mercy really to provide some guidelines and framework for what we call resocialization of both youth and high school sports in the St. Louis region. And so really that specifically speaks to recommendations surrounding returning to sports. And so we call it resocialization based off of the CDC guidelines because reality is it's more about the entire concept surrounding sports rather than just the activity of sports themselves. It's really pretty complicated when we look at sort of getting back into what our new normal is going to be in regards to sports. And that's really what these guidelines are. It's really a roadmap, hopefully, for organizations and coaches and schools to try to ease back into a very phased approach into sports.
Hit some of the highlights of these guidelines.
Yeah, so the really big thing to remember about these guidelines is it's multi-part. So the first part of the recommendations are some basic guidelines to follow in how we approach sports. So simple things like screenings prior to any sort of activity of any kind is probably the biggest recommendation that we're giving, and that you'll see that in many different sets of guidelines, both by counties and cities everywhere. We talk about employee health screenings, and that's important, but we also need to be screening these kids because they're going to potentially be in very close contact in some of these phases. And so we need to be screening them for, first off, their signs and symptoms to basically report if they've had any COVID-19 similar symptoms, as well as checking for a fever. That's really imperative to make sure that we're screening kids negative before they do participate. And then what we've basically done is we've created two categories. So we have a high frequency of contact sports, which has sports like basketball, football, soccer, things where we have a high frequency of coming in contact with one another. And then there's a low frequency phase. So things that are more individual in nature, things like gymnastics, things like weightlifting, golf, that realistically there's very little contact. But there's a phased approach for each of these. So high contact sports have four different phases, and low frequency sports have three different phases. And both of them start about the same time. So what our current recommendation is that as long as in the county that you reside, that there is still continued either stable or continued downward trajectory of COVID-19 cases in your region for a minimum of 14 days straight, then we're recommending that about June 15th is the recommended start date for both youth and high school athletics in the region. And again, that's basically as long as we get that continued downward trajectory. That's really the key here. And then each phase is based on that same gating criteria, and that's set by the CDC. So we want to see 2 weeks consistently of a downward trajectory of those cases, and then we can kind of move into the next phase. The first phase is very simple. It's really 10 or less individuals in a space, and we're limiting that contact as much as possible and really encouraging social distancing, but while doing some type of activity at the same time. And then the phases really increase from there. Our goal is that if we are able to continue to see these downward trajectory of cases, that we will be able to move through those phases as well. We don't know, which is why that gating criteria is really important, is that we don't want to see these outbreaking cases or these spikes in cases as we really reopen our region. It's important to understand that piece of it, and we're really here to help guide organizations through that.
Katie, what do the guidelines say about the use of locker rooms or allowing spectators at the games?
So use of locker rooms is really not recommended at this time. Realistically, we want to encourage as much social distancing outside of that direct contact that has to occur in some of those phases. We really don't want them using those locker rooms or really any type of common area, because one of the other things that's recommended is that we also separate and have changes about the amount of time in between activities and really spread out practices and games so that there's limited or no interaction between these different groups of sports or teams. And so locker room really encourages them to be in a very close space. So we don't encourage that. If you have a big enough locker room that you can social distance and separate, let's say, every three lockers or so, so they don't really have to have any interaction, that's okay. But for the most part, we really want to not use those common areas. In addition, we really don't want spectators in most of these phases as well. When we get into game or competition phases, some spectators are realistically probably going to be allowed. But we really want to limit that, because the reality is that our concern is much higher for our spectators than it is our kids, realistically. Kids, what we're seeing right now is they have a much higher immunity and they handle COVID-19 much better than adults. And our concern is that, yes, kids can bring this home to their families, but also having spectators in close quarters is much more likely to lead to an outbreak in cases, really even more than the kids. So we really want to limit that in the practice scenario. If kids are old enough to get out of the car, be screened themselves, we really encourage more of a carpool line to eliminate all of that extra parent interaction during these activities.
What about a common practice of sharing water bottles?
So that's another really big and simple thing that we're encouraging teams to do, is to encourage their athletes to bring their own individual water bottle labels, and to eliminate things like the use of a cooler if possible. If a cooler has to be used, it should be one cooler per team or per group. Really limiting use of things like water fountains. If you have a water fountain, we would prefer if you had a no-touch refill station, so that you're having as much or as little contact with the same things over and over. Things like bathrooms should still be used, but if we can encourage additional uses of other restrooms, so we're not all using one restroom, that's also encouraged. And if they are using those restrooms, that we're limiting the number of people coming and going at that same time to limit the chance of transmission in that scenario as well. Really trying to eliminate the use of cups, the use of things like cubbies in a lot of organizations or break rooms or common areas, and really limiting the entrances and exits to facilities, especially indoor facilities. That's much more concerning. Outdoor facilities, it's a little bit easier to manage that. But really limiting the amount of people that are coming in and out. And then every individual that is coming in and out needs to be screened as well.
We're talking with Katie Smith. Katie is the Sports Medicine Outreach Manager at SSM Health. Katie, what about handshakes and fist bumps?
So I think that realistically, any type of handshakes, high fives, fist bumps, even those team huddles are really going to be something that's going to be eliminated for quite some time. I think really when people read these guidelines, our hope is to help people understand what our version of our new normal is. Those are things that realistically it is going to not be something that we're going to recommend for a really long time. Until this is something that we're no longer dealing with on a regular basis, we really can't do that. The transmission rate is just simply too high in those. And so much of this phased approach is also helping kids to start to understand that. We realize that kids have been high-fiving each other and fist-bumping each other and giving each other hugs for a long time. And so we really have to start to break some of those habits if we're going to allow them to return. And it's really important that our coaches and our administrators and our officials and parents really help kids to understand that and educate them on the importance of that, so that they hopefully can help follow some of these guidelines to limit the number of outbreaks and increase transmission rates that we're going to start to see realistically.
Katie, what's the guideline on who should wear masks?
So really, any individuals who are in public of any kind that are not able to social distance of a minimum of 6 feet and are not engaged in vigorous physical activity should really be in a mask. So that includes any spectators at any of these events. That includes parents dropping off their children. And really, it involves the kids who are participating in sport up until the time that they are participating in a vigorous activity. So we don't want kids in a mask who are running around and doing a high amount of intense activity. But while they're in line being screened, while they're waiting for their workout or practice to begin, they can certainly be wearing those. also while they're sitting on a bench or having a team meeting, they can have them on. Really, coaches should have them on the entire time. That's very important as they are likely carriers of this as well. So any individuals that they're really around, and when you're not doing that activity, they really do need to have that mask on. And again, that's going to be part of our norm for quite some time. So getting kids used to this idea of having the mask on, and that it's not scary, that doesn't mean that you're necessarily sick, but it's a protection for others around you as well as yourself.
Katie, where can we go to find a complete list of these recommendations?
So you can visit our SSM Health website. If you go to our main page and scroll all the way down to the bottom, you'll see a link to the full list of recommendations. BJC and Mercy is also offering these guidelines on their website as well. There's the full list of recommendations, including the phases. And then you'll also find a contact person for each of our health systems that if you have questions or you want recommendations specific to your facility or want clarifications or anything like that, our contact information is all listed on the recommendations as well. So please feel free to reach out if you have questions or want further guidance on this topic.
Katie, thanks a lot for joining us.
You bet. Happy to be here.
Katie Smith is the Sports Medicine Outreach Manager at SSM Health. We're joined now on the phone by SLU Cares Dr. Fred Buchhold. Dr. Buchhold is a general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Buchhold, thanks for joining us again.
My pleasure.
Dr. Buchhold, how are we doing when it comes to testing for coronavirus? I know Missouri ranks number 41 out of all 50 states for the total number of tests conducted. Are we still having a problem?
Yes, it's better. And a lot of people locally are working incredibly hard on this and making do. But, you know, we're still not at the point where we could do testing on a larger scale if we needed to or wanted to. And there's probably some differences of opinion about who to test and what to test. I'm still strongly that I think, I strongly in favor of, I think if we had our way, you know, particularly people that are kind of out and exposed, so healthcare workers, workers at other critical areas, should get frequent testing, you know, if they haven't tested positive yet. But, you know, if you go to a medical facility and you need testing, we can do it. But if we had larger numbers of this, I think our supplies would really dwindle down quickly. So it's still a very tenuous situation.
Missouri Governor Mike Parson hopes to increase the number of tests being done in Missouri. And when that happens, he guarantees there will be a spike in cases.
It is critical to understand that the more tests we do, the more positive cases there will be. By increasing testing, we can continue to slow the spread by identifying positive patients and isolating them as quickly as possible. The testing that we're doing today, it seems like every month we're trying to catch our breath with something, how we deal with COVID-19. But the more tests we can do today also prepares us more for this fall. There's a short-term goal of getting those tests done on a daily basis, but the long-term goal is to prepare for the future of the state and for Missouri to move forward. And as we move forward, testing will be critical to Missouri's full economic recovery and giving Missourians more confidence to be out.
Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's to be expected. And you know, I think the elephant in the room about this is the fact that there's probably huge swaths of people that are positive or have COVID that haven't exhibited symptoms, or they've had symptoms and have recovered and they didn't really recognize that it might be COVID. So, you know, the more testing you do, I mean, it's a known phenomenon. The more testing you do, the more people you diagnose. Same is true when we started doing mass mammograms for women over the age of 50, the number of cases of breast cancer increased. So that doesn't suggest that there's like a worsened epidemic. It just means you're getting a more accurate picture of what's out there. That doesn't surprise me at all, and I'd expect that. I don't think it would change the amount of people that are critically ill from COVID. It just gives you a better picture of what's out there with COVID. And again, a lot of these numbers, if we talked about, as Dr. Fauci said, is, you know, we're probably underestimating the number of people that have it, the number of people that have it been sick in a healthcare facility, and frankly, the number of people that died. You know, the 90,000 that we're at now, which is an incredible number, is probably low. It's probably much, much higher than that. And I think that's because we're not having enough testing to know what we're really dealing with yet.
Dr. Buchhold, how can we tell if a possible spike is because of more testing or more new cases due to the lifting of restrictions?
I think the thing will be what presents to healthcare, to a healthcare facility. So for instance, at my institution at SLU Hospital, at the peak, I've got to do the math here real quick, about 15 to 20% of our hospitalized cases were of COVID. I think our peak number, was in the 40s out of a census of about 200. So yeah, it's about 20%. You know, if that percentage gets higher, particularly if patients are in the ICU, that suggests there's going to be an increase, that they were having a spike of COVID cases. In other words, you know, everybody that gets COVID, there's a certain percentage that are going to be very, very ill. So the number of patients that are very, very ill go up, then the percentage of people that have COVID is going up, if that makes sense. I don't think the math of that percentage of people that get ill from COVID changes. It might change a little bit, but I think that would be a general rule of thumb. When our healthcare system gets overwhelmed, that's when you know we're having a spike in cases, long story short.
We're talking with Dr. Fred Buchholz. Dr. Buchholz is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Buchholz, I'm seeing a new study that says most elderly patients on ventilators don't come off. Tell us what that means to you.
Well, this is, you know, this is not a phenomenon unique to COVID. You know, I think most of us that have experienced taking care of seriously ill patients, the older you are and you're put on a ventilator, so a machine to help you to breathe, or you're sick enough to be in ICU, your odds of recovery decline the older you get, as a general rule of thumb. And so, you know, if you're afflicted with COVID and you're sick enough to be in the ICU and you need a ventilator to help you to breathe, the chances of a meaningful recovery quickly decline. And the longer you're on that, the longer you require that sustenance, the chance of recovery go lower and lower and lower as the days go. And if you ask most physicians, you know, particularly as they age, there's no way they would want any of that stuff. And that's a fairly consistent thread amongst physicians, because they know that it approaches your options dwindle very, very quickly. And, you know, that's not how I think a lot of people want to pass, is to be hooked up to a machine in isolation, away from your family members and loved ones, kind of a cold hospital room. That's not, I don't think, anybody's ideal scenario of death. You know, this is, you know, again, I think something worth talking about. I think if you're, you know, above the age of 65, or really at any age, you should be having discussions with your family about what you would want, and, you know, what types of circumstances would be there, would exist that would say, I no longer want this type of care. These are conversations you should certainly have with your doctor. And just understand, you know, we are always, you know, no matter what, as healthcare providers, we will always provide care. But, you know, sometimes putting people on respirators is not the appropriate treatment. You know, letting nature take its course, and, you know, is sometimes the most appropriate thing. We still care for you for that. We still make you comfortable and work to make sure that all your needs are met. But, you know, these are a lot of resources that may not have any benefit for a lot of patients, unfortunately.
Dr. Buchholz, does having a common cold offer any sort of coronavirus protection?
Well, I think the question is, nobody knows. I don't think so, because we've probably all had coronavirus. The odds are just so high that almost everybody's had some form of coronavirus during their lifetime. It's one of the most common causes of the common cold. So I don't think, the fact that so many people are infected with this novel virus suggests that there's probably no cross immunity, but it's unknown. I mean, there's some work being done on this, or, you know, have people, does the duration of exposure or previous exposure modify your reaction to being infected with COVID? Nobody really knows at this point. That work is ongoing, and will take some time to figure out.
I have a listener question for you today, Dr. Buchholz. This listener wants to know, how might the whole COVID-19 situation change hospitals down the road?
That's it's something I've wondered a lot myself. I don't think anybody knows yet. I will say a couple things that I've kind of pondered and thought about. One is, you know, I think it shows how important hospitals are for, you know, health, and in a very specific way, in the sense of when people get acutely ill, that's the place you want to go to get care. That said, I think there's some other things that people go to the hospital for that may not be something we do normally. Hospitals are always, you know, places where they carry a lot of risks. So there's risks of infections, you know, that the longer you stay there, the more likely you are to get a healthcare-related infection, which is a phenomenon we've been dealing with for a long time. you know, now that you go there, there's a risk of getting COVID. And I think that's what's kept a lot of people away, at least at the start of this pandemic in the United States. So, you know, I think the types of people that go to seek care at a hospital will certainly change. And I think they'll become more places for kind of that high acuity treatment where, you know, there's no other option but to be in a hospital. And I think with the, you know, we've kind of just kind of exploded in this telemedicine capability. You know, a lot of things will shift to that where people may come for to get evaluated or, you know, be seen by a specialist. That can be done possibly over the phone now or virtually, which is in my mind great. I think the big question, I'm trying to be a little careful here, is you know what this does to kind of the optional stuff that's available. So you know elective procedures or non urgent procedures, how are those done and where are those done? I think are going to be kind of an ongoing thing that I'm curious to see evolve. And then last, I think it just shows how important you know really really good training is. So it shows how important you know well trained, well compensated, well cared for nurses, how vital they are. And I would argue, you know, physicians that are expert in caring for seriously ill patients, that's not something you learn in a day. You know, it takes 7 to 10 years of training, starting with medical school to train a person well versed in caring for a patient in the ICU. And, you know, you can't substitute that training because it's that training and nuance that leads us to figure out new therapies and new treatments kind of on the fly. I think that training is central and important and should continue to be supported. My bias, because I'm one of those people, but I do think we've shown our value and you know the types of people we care for, the types of training we have, I think is important and valuable.
Dr. Buckle, thanks a lot for everything that you do. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thank you, Fred.
Dr. Fred Buchholz is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. This is KMOX health editor Fred Bottomer. Thanks so much for joining us for today's podcast, Coronavirus Facts Only. Talk to you again tomorrow.